Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. It's a truism that our healthcare system is broken. As a nation, we spend more than $3 trillion on healthcare goods and services every year, 50% more than the next nation per capita. And in spite of all that spending, our outcomes are far from the best in terms of life expectancy, maternal and infant mortality, and even quality of life. But our collective belief is that U.S. healthcare is the best in the world. Maybe a rationalization, or maybe because our heavy spending brings us the latest and greatest gizmos, but neglects the basics. This is but one of the contentions of my guest today, Dr. Robert Pearl, who just completed 18 years as the CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, the physicians group of Kaiser Permanente that cares for 5 million people along the west and east coasts of the United States. Kaiser Permanente is an integrated, multi-specialty care delivery system that puts an emphasis on outcomes, value, cost efficiency, and using technology to enhance the patient experience. They are always mentioned in lists of the best-performing healthcare systems. Dr. Pearl has just written a new book called Mistreated: Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong. And in it, he breaks down the problems in U.S. healthcare and offers solutions for how we could get more value for our healthcare dollars. In addition to his work at Kaiser, Dr. Pearl is a columnist at Forbes.com and a professor at Stanford, both in the business and medical schools. Dr. Robert Pearl, author of the book Mistreated, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Robert Pearl, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start with your father's story, which I think in many ways was the impetus for your writing this book, Mistreated. Tell us about what happened to him and what was so surprising about that.
So my father, Jack, was an amazing man. He was the son of two immigrant parents. He worked his way through college, worked his way through dental school. In World War II, as a captain, he could have stayed behind the American lines, taking care of people with medical problems. Instead, he volunteered to join the 101st Airborne, parachuted on D-Day behind German lines. The troops that he led were captured by the Germans. He led a daring escape at night through the forest, returned safely, brought all the men back safely. He was an energetic man. He rarely slept more than 5 or 6 hours a night. And then one day he got tired, which was very unusual for him. And he was found to have a hemolytic anemia. His body was breaking down his own red blood cells. He had a trial of medication, which was not successful, and underwent a very successful operation, a splenectomy, for the spleen is the filter of the red blood cells, and if it's overly filtering, then that's what creates this anemia, and it corrected his problem. At the same time, the spleen filters out certain bacteria, one particular one being the pneumococcus, and every physician who cared for him knew that he needed a vaccine against this particular organism. He spent half his year in Florida, half his year in New York, but the doctors in Florida thought the ones in New York had administered it. The ones in New York thought Florida had given it to him. Primary care thought specialty care had given it to him. Specialty thought primary care would have. And in the end, he never had it. He came out to visit my brother and me. My brother's the chief anesthesia at Stanford. We had a wonderful day, a great dinner. He went to my brother's house, went to sleep that night. My brother woke up the next morning at 5 a.m. to go to rounds. He found my father unresponsive on the floor. Oy. My dad was admitted to the critical care unit at Stanford, spent 4 more days unresponsive, 3 weeks in the hospital. And although he didn't die from that particular episode, he died from the complications thereof. And the diagnosis? Pneumococcal septicemia. One of 200,000 people that year to have died from a medical error.
You had this very dark personal experience with this, and there's so many things that we can read into it. And of course, there's the information exchange issue, I guess, in some ways primary, where you already mentioned this, where, you know, New York doctors thought Florida doctors had done it and vice versa. And we still have problems like this, even with the advent of information technology and, you know, the vast majority of medical practices now using electronic medical records. How are we making progress or not making progress in this realm?
So the American healthcare system is broken. It most closely resembles a 19th century English cottage industry. It's fragmented. Doctors scattered across the community, usually unconnected with each other. Hospitals in every town, also unconnected either with each other or with doctors. It's paid on a piecemeal basis. We call it fee-for-service. So physicians are going to be less attentive to some of the things that are not going to be interventional, but instead be preventive or avoidance of complications. As you say, the technology exists, but when we talk about electronic health record, we often mean just a computer. But a computer is not an electronic health record. A comprehensive electronic health record requires that all of a patient's information from every doctor they've seen be available to the next doctor who will care for them. And that is relatively rare, except for large multi-specialty medical groups. So the solution, I believe, is going to be to integrate, to bring doctors together, to work as one. Patients believe that doctors are fully integrated, but we know, and you're a physician, that they're not. They very often work in their offices or work in their specialty and don't go across to other physicians in the same community in their specialty or other specialties that might exist that the patient's going to be seen. We know that they don't have the information at every point of contact, and as a result, patients fall through the cracks. In fact, I estimate that hundreds of thousands of people die every year because of omissions in prevention, because of the kinds of medical error my dad had, and because they have chronic illnesses and develop complications that could have been avoided. But that's not the system we have. I began the book, as you say, part of it around my father, but I also began it around the question of the dichotomy between what we believe and the facts. What we believe, most Americans, is that the health care, the medical care provided in the United States is the best in the world. Maybe too expensive, but the best in the world. The data says that we're actually in the lower half of the 20 most industrialized countries of the world. In fact, we're last in life expectancy. A girl born in Seoul, Korea today has an average life expectancy of 90. In the United States, 83. We're next to last in childhood mortality. We actually do a pretty poor job. And the result is that these hundreds of thousands of people die. So the question I pose to myself is, why would we think we're getting great health care, and when why are we not? And what the book demonstrates is that much of what we believe doesn't come from data. It comes from context. That context shapes perception that then, very importantly, affects behavior. So I talk in the book about a study that many of us looked at in college, the Stanford Prison Experiment. Zimbardo takes normal students. He divides half of them into jailers, gives them aviator sunglasses. Half become jailees. They get OR-type tops with numbers instead of names. 48 hours later, the jailers are treating these other students. They know they're students, but they treat them like they're hardened criminals, like they're dangerous. They inflict debasing punishments, making them clean toilets with their bare hands. And the jailees see the jailers as being sadistic, boarding up the doors. They should logically know that they're just other students. But that's not how context shapes perception and therefore behavior. And that's what I see in healthcare today. The great opportunity is that if we reverse everything, if you start integrating physicians together as one, you put them in the same medical group, all of a sudden other doctors are not competitors. All of a sudden you're on the same team, and people start to work in a collaborative, cooperative way, getting better results. As soon as you pay them, not on a fee-for-service basis that simply rewards volume, whether it has any positive outcome or not is irrelevant, but on value, on the superior outcomes they get, suddenly now they start to value things like prevention. They start to make sure there are no medical errors. They start to avoid the kinds of complications for which, if it happened, they could actually bill. But now they have an incentive to keep you healthy. And when you give them the information technology in a comprehensive system, now all of a sudden patients don't fall the cracks, and all the physicians caring for a single patient can focus on the same opportunities together.
And Dr. Pearl, I was wondering if you could share the story with us of, I think she's your colleague, Dr. Diane Craig in Santa Clara, who based on or tied to the story of your father's pneumococcal sepsis, and you mentioned 200,000 cases of this per year, so a significant morbidity and mortality, people getting essentially a bacteria in the bloodstream that leads to multi-system organ failure and they die. She found something, a relatively simple discriminator, where you could predict whether or not people were going to wind up with severe sepsis. And she worked incredibly hard to disseminate that information and was very successful in doing it at her one hospital or through the Kaiser system, it sounds like. And yet there's still all kinds of resistance in the broader medical community to adopt this practice. Can you comment on that?
Sure, John. Let's go back to that same theme of how context shapes perception, changes behavior. We see the same thing in brain scans. What you see in a brain scan is that in times of great reward or great fear, that the part of the brain associated with either reward center or the amygdala for the fear center become activated, light up, and very quickly the parts of our brain related to perception then kick in and change what we see. And this is what Diane Craig was looking at. So Diane was looking at hospital mortality, and she noticed that year over year over year it was declining very well, and suddenly it plateaued. And so she decided to look inside the comprehensive electronic health system to understand what was going on. She expected to see deaths were happening from heart attack. Maybe there was some new phenomenon, a dietary consequence, or strokes, the traditional things that people die from in the hospital. And lo and behold, what she find? The most common cause of death was sepsis infection. 1 in 6 patients. But what she then noted is that only 2% of the patients admitted to the hospital had this diagnosis, and yet 1 in 6 was dying. She then did something that was very interesting, which is that she started to look in greater detail now at this population who ended up dying from infection. And what she saw is that about half of the patients came in very, very sick. They had traditional sepsis. Every ED physician in the United States recognized it. Every one of them would treat it. But she also saw that half of the people died, particularly those who were relatively young, died having been admitted with what seemed to be a mild infection. They were obviously sick enough to come in the hospital, but they maybe had a kidney infection or a lung infection, the kinds of problems that we should be able to treat with the conventional approach. She then did a fascinating thing. She now took people with the same kind of problems who would go on to die versus those who would go on to live, and now looked deeper inside their comprehensive electronic health record. And this is where we have to have a little bit of medical science. So there's a particular test, a measurement of the blood lactate level, that doctors know that if it's below 2, you're fine, it's normal. And if it's above 4, you're pretty sick. But this intermediate zone between 2 and 4 started to fascinate her. And what she saw is that those patients who were treated aggressively in this intermediate zone lived at a far higher percentage than those who were not treated. And so she started to recommend that all people in this intermediate zone get treated. It makes logical sense. Now we're back, think about that Stanford Prison Experiment. We're back to logic. More people will live, scientifically proven. And now the question you're posing is, why didn't they do it? And this is where the perception part comes in. Because what you know as a physician, but your audience may not, and that doctors don't see all deaths the same. A death that a doctor causes is far worse than a death that happens simply from the disease. If you take 10 people in category A and 10 in category B, and a treatment in A is going to save 9, and a treatment in B is going to save only 6, and not treating, and the other group would only have 6, everyone would think logically going to treat. But if the one patient who dies is someone who might have otherwise lived in the first group, doctors are now not going to want to do it, even though 50% higher survival, because their perception of that death is so much worse than the 3 people who got saved as a result of that treatment. So this is where the perception has an impact. And so what do? They admit the patient to the hospital. They give them a minor treatment because the aggressive treatment that saved all those lives has a danger. You got to give a lot of fluids. At the time that she did her research, she had to put a large catheter into the neck to measure the pressure to administer the fluids, and there were sometimes complications as a result of that. But what was also interesting to me, because this gets back to how do we reshape that perception, is she started giving people lanyards with these numbers on them so that now it was visible to them. They could no longer ignore the need to draw the test. And then she embedded it inside the computer systems. And what was the result? She lowered the mortality 40% below the national average. Of course, in America today, death from sepsis is about 15%. In Santa Clara, it's 8%, more than 40% down. What's needed now is to figure out how to do that across the whole country. And again, this is where, to me, the idea of having the integrated system, so all the doctors work together, and it's not Dr. A handing a patient off to B and forgetting about the patient. They're working together as one. And they have the incentive, and they have the data, and they have the information. And most importantly, I believe, they have the physician leadership. Doctors will not follow hospital administrators or insurance executives. They don't trust them. This is where the perception part comes in again. But they will follow colleagues whom they've worked with and whom they respect. And I think this is the opportunity that we have in moving from the current 19th century cottage industry to what I believe is the 21st century system. But one more thing, it's not just the doctors, it's the patients. I mean, have your listeners think about the following. Why do they accept so much less in the health care they receive than they would in banking or travel or retail? How many of them would be willing to use a bank which required them to come there between 9 and 5 Monday to Friday to get their balance, and they couldn't get it online? And yet how many of them can go online and get the information on the laboratory radiology test they just had done? How many of them would fly on an airline that did not allow them to purchase a ticket electronically? And yet how many of them can schedule a doctor's office visit online? How many of them Skype with their friends and children around the globe? And yet how many of them can do a video visit with their physicians? This is the same phenomenon that affects doctors as affects patients. One, a couple other examples I think that are fascinating, and maybe it's being a little too graphic for your audience, but study after study after study, almost 100 studies have shown that 1 in 3 times when a doctor goes from hospital room A to B, he or she does not wash their hands. Think about that. 1 in 3 times. Studies have been repeated in every community, in every area. As you know, every physician understands that a common infection called C. difficile is carried on the hands of people. It doesn't travel in the air from one room to the other room. Give them a test, every one of them will get it right. They'll score 100. They know exactly what they're supposed to do, and yet they don't do it. Somehow they perceive, because they're in a rush, because they're late for their office, because of something, that they can't possibly carry a bacteria. It makes no more sense than the Stanford Prison Experiment. But that's how this subconscious process works in our brain, and the result is hundreds of thousands of people dying every year prematurely and unnecessarily.
Dr. Pearl, I want to come back to one aspect that you alluded to. You talk a lot about the technology and the deep dive that Diane Craig made, or the integrated system where you have multiple specialists working on the same team and being able to use the electronic medical record. You mentioned Skype visits or virtual visits. And in the book, you give the stories of Emma and Felipe. Emma is a young child, really a baby, who unfortunately has a scald burn and sounds like comes from a fairly well-to-do family. Felipe, on the other hand, sounds like an immigrant, and he's diabetic and he's going blind. And yet both of these examples, where you think the socioeconomics are so different, are able to, I assume they're Kaiser patients, you don't explicitly say that, but are able to, where one of the barriers is transportation to and from multiple medical visits for dressing changes for a burn or for better diabetes care. Both of these examples are able to visit with different doctors or nurses online through the telemedicine, and it seems to work exceptionally well. And not only that, it provides a great deal of comfort to the patients, just knowing that they can be listened to and validated without having to leave their home or spend hours in traffic or bundling up a burned child for whom, you know, putting her in a car seat is akin to torture. Can you comment on why there's been such little adoption of telemedicine and other healthcare systems that aren't integrated?
Sure. So one of the opportunities I have is to also be the chairman of the Council of Accountable Physician Practices. And that's the nation's 28 largest, and I like to think of best medical groups. It's the Kaiser Permanente's, but it's also Intermountain Health. It's Mayo Clinic. It's Geisinger. And one of those patients was a Kaiser Permanente member, but the other was not, because she was also an integrated type system of care. Ask physicians about telemedicine. They're likely to tell you, oh, it's not as good, it's not as safe. But let's go back to the same thesis of context, shifting perception, changing behavior. Why might they perceive it that way? Because I'm going to tell you it's exactly the opposite, as you've pointed out. It's actually better care. You don't have to bring a patient in once every couple of weeks. You can make a short visit over video on a frequent basis. Well, the first thing is economics. In most of healthcare today, they don't get paid if they do a virtual visit. In that case, you're going to perceive an inpatient visit as being much better. And why are they not paid? They're not paid because the healthcare insurance company doesn't trust the doctor, that the doctor won't just simply generate more and more visits, because this is now another source of revenue in this pay-for-volume, not pay-for-value type system. It's broken, but it can't be unbroken. And for the patient, now remember, we're not talking about every problem, but for the problems that are applicable, why should they drive? Why should they have to miss work or school to get there? And there's a second component to it. And this relates back to this issue of the computer system. Because it's not just enough to have a virtual visit. What you'd like to have is all the information available. And if you don't have the comprehensive information, then you're in a situation where that visit is far less valuable. There are some video companies across the United States that will do video visits for the minor type problems. What I emphasize in the book is how much more powerful it is when you're having that video visit with a physician you know and trust, whether in primary care or specialty care. And I use the example of my father. My father, as one of the consequences of his hospitalization and his being unresponsive for several days, developed an ulcer of his foot that required a physician to look at it on a periodic basis, once a week. And my sister, who was the CEO of a major organization in the United States, actually a national organization, had to miss work every week to go to his apartment, that was an hour drive, pick him up and take him to the doctor for literally was a five-minute visit, take him back home, drive back. She missed a half day of work every week simply because the doctor didn't have that technology available. It could have been done, but when you're not being paid for it, you don't see it as being as valuable as you are when you're a patient.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Robert Pearl, who until recently was the chief executive officer of the Permanente Medical Group with Kaiser Permanente. He's a columnist for Forbes.com, and he's the author of the fabulous new book called Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong. We've talked about some of the benefits of good technology. You make the point later in the book that, you know, all that glitters is not gold. So it's sort of a caveat about the fact that maybe always following where technology is going is not in, say, the patient's best interest.
So much of the technology that exists, and I think we're often attracted to it because it's hyped by newspapers, is related to technology that is pretty expensive. I do say, as you point out, John, that there's a lot of technology, like video, that's very inexpensive and can be made broadly available. There's data analytics. So as an example, today in Kaiser Permanente, what we do is we have a computer that's analyzing the data on all the hospitalized patients. And those patients who the computer is predicting will be in the ICU tomorrow is identified today, so that intervention can happen, because if you intervene before the patient has the catastrophe, the mortality is only 1/4 as great as if you wait till after that to happen. And the same thing is being done for patients in the emergency room. So that opportunity to use technology in very powerful ways is something that does exist. This, on the other side, though, you have technology. A lot of the current thinking around wearable devices, I think, reflects that. Technology is developed that, let's say, allows you to take a heart reading, a heart tracing, a rhythm strip, and transmit that information to the doctor. You're a physician. How many EKGs or how many rhythm strips do you need to see on 98% of patients? 1, 2, 3. If they're all normal, the likelihood of finding an abnormality is very, very low. But when you have this technology, you start to hype it. And now you start to say, well, we can send 100. As physicians, we know it doesn't make any difference, but it sounds very good. And where are we going to send it? We'll send it to the doctor's office. Now think about this. As a physician, do you want to be getting 100 rhythm strips on all your patients every single day? You're not going to look at it. You're not going to evaluate it. What's really needed? What's really needed is an internal application inside the device that tells the patient you're probably having a problem. Similar to the data analytics I was talking about for the hospitalized patients. And now those patients can call the doctor, and now the doctor really wants to know, because now there may be a real problem sitting there. And the technology exists to do that. Why are none of the devices incorporating that? because of the malpractice risk.
Yeah, that was something that was really interesting to me. I mean, and you used the example of Uber and how many of the startup companies, you know, particularly in Silicon Valley but elsewhere, are trying to create that killer medical app. But it was sort of a new idea for me that the reason that there hasn't really been a successful one is because they're afraid, if you will, of the liability. Can you say more about that?
Well, I think it's a combination of two things. Number one is afraid of a liability. So if the computer makes any applications you know as a physician, it's a statistical probability. And so there will be someone somewhere who's going to get it too much or too little, all dependent upon how you set the dials. That's how we practice in medicine all the time. But as soon as it's associated with the device, now the patient's family or the patient is going to run the risk of suing that particular individual. But one of the themes to me that's so important in this book is how much we focus on this rescue opportunity, this technology opportunity, and we miss the fundamentals. As you know, half of the people in the United States are not screened for colon cancer every year. Half of the deaths are preventable. 100,000 people dying every year unnecessarily. And in patients who don't have a history of colon cancer in their family or any other predisposing factor, which is the majority of people, a FIT test done 5 minutes in your bathroom once a year in privacy with no risk and no bowel prep, if you do it every year, it's as good as colonoscopy. And yet, how much do we hear about FIT test versus colonoscopy? Or hypertension. Hypertension is the number one cause of ischemic strokes. And yet what we know is across the United States today, we only control it 55% of the time. The best medical groups control it 90% of the time. But we don't pay much attention to it because it doesn't glitter. It's not sexy. But it's the thing that saves lives. And that's where, as you say, we have the opportunity to focus on the things that are going to be making a difference. One of the things that I teach in the Stanford Business School, and a lot of my students are entrepreneurs, and I say you always want to start with what problem are you trying to solve. And I love to point out the wearable exercise devices. And I ask them, how many of you have it on? And, of course, a lot of people have it on. And the data says that they actually don't change anything about exercise unless you're already a very, very committed exercise person, in which case you don't need it. Then you look at the economics. I take out the, you know, the data sheets, the financial performance. What do you see? Tremendous industry generating huge profits. And then I pose the question, why? And the answer is because it solves a very important problem. It just is not a medical problem. It solves what I like to call the December dilemma. Whether it's Christmas or Hanukkah, you have someone coming up, you love them a lot, you want to show them how much you are concerned about them, you want them to wear it all the time, you'd like it to be a little cool, and you want the cost between $150 and $200, and the exercise wearable exactly fits that definition, so people will buy it year after year after year. It's not a question of what the data shows. It's context shaping perception, changing behavior. By the way, for those listeners who are a bit older, in the 1990s, it was the inline skates. And 50% of the inline skates never came out of the box again, except for the one day on which they were being given. Finding technology that solves real problems, whether the problems are medical or not, is a different question. Those are the ones that are going to be most successful, and those are the ones for which you don't need to hype them. You just can trust the individual in the context to decide to buy them as wonderful gifts for their loved ones.
That's such a great contrarian point that you made that I think is what makes the book so rich. The name of the book is Mistreated. Dr. Pearl, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, John. It's been a privilege.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.